Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Congressman Danny Davis of Illinois, Republican Bruno Barron, and journalist John McCarron. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, a bitter Chicago, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email, the email address is btb@museum.tv. And when I say a bitter Chicago, I meant to say bitter cold. But again, perhaps there are some bitter Bear fans as well. As you know, it is a sad day for Bear fans in Chicago and those listening around the country because the Bears failed to make the big comeback against the Green Bay Packers in the fourth quarter with an interception by our third-string quarterback, Caleb Haney. So the Bear season is over. The Pack goes on to the Super Bowl against a team to be named later on this evening. So while the Bear season is over, on Tuesday, President Barack Obama will deliver his State of the Union address to Congress and the nation, and beginning the second half of his first term as Commander-in-Chief. Today, the President previewed his remarks with supporters, releasing a YouTube video highlighting the themes of Tuesday's address.
My principal focus, my number one focus, is going to be making sure that we are competitive, that we are growing, and we are creating jobs, not just now, but well into the future. And that's what is going to be the main topic of the State of the Union.
By bypassing reporters and appealing directly to the American people, it seems that the president's focus is firmly on creating jobs and continuing to rebuild the economy. The president couched the framework of his State of the Union preview in the language of American competitiveness. Let's listen.
We're going to have to out-innovate. We're going to have to out-build. We're going to have to out-compete. We're going to have to out-educate other countries. That's our challenge. We're also going to have to deal with our deficits and our debt in a responsible way. And we've got to reform government so that it's leaner and smarter for the 21st century.
Our Republican tonight is Bruno Barron. Do you hear these words? Do they inspire you? Do they give you any sense of confidence? Has the president really stepped towards the center or stepping in a direction that you could applaud?
Well, clearly with the compromise on the tax hike and extending all of the Bush tax cuts for 2 years, Barack Obama did himself the best thing he possibly could, which is clearly show people, okay, I compromised, we did this, I didn't just go after people, the rich, and do the class warfare thing. So there's evidence that he's going in that direction. I'm much more skeptical on this whole regulatory scheme. He spends for the first 2 years regulating carbon dioxide, regulating everything under the sun, creating 150 new bureaucracies with health care, regulating health care, taking over health care. And then after all of this spending and all of this re-regulation of everything he possibly could, saying, oh, we're going to look at regulation. I mean, I think we should all be very skeptical about that. But if he does what he says, he, like any other president who looked successful in the last 2 years of his term, has a shot at reelection.
Congressman Danny Davis also joins us, veteran Illinois Democrat, longtime member of Congress and representing the West Side in portions of downtown Chicago, member of the House Ways and Means Committee. Danny, nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Should mention many years ago, a regular panel on this program when you were a member of the Chicago City Council, so it's always good to have you back on the air. The Barack Obama that we will hear on Tuesday night, is it going to be just stylistically different than what we've heard in before, or do you think he read the election tea leaves and is preparing to backpedal a little bit politically?
Well, I think he's already backpedaled a bit. I would have wanted to add stabilizing and rebuilding the economy, because I think we've still got to do some work to just simply stabilize the economy in terms of where we are and what we need to do. I certainly agree with those who suggest that the president has made a tremendous effort to compromise. As a matter of fact, I compromised with him on the tax question and actually took a vote that in many instances and in many times I would probably not have taken the same vote, but because of the fact that I want to work to help stabilize and I want to help to compromise wherever possible, but I don't want to go overboard. I mean, I don't want to throw out the baby along with the bathwater in an effort to do this. So I think the president is serious. I mean, if you ask people that I represent and people who interact a great deal with me, they would think that not only is the president serious, but he might be becoming too much of a centrist for their liking.
John McCarron, you are a journalist. You teach at DePaul University journalism, but you're also you're politically progressive, and you're proud of it. You have been critical of Barack Obama in the past, that maybe he has been a little bit too weak, caves too quickly. Are we going to see more caving on Tuesday night?
No, I don't think so. I think the rhetoric certainly will be kind of soft and warm, and let's all get together. Typical, you know, Barack Obama. That's just the way he is. But I think he's going to come out with some prospects that are going to be sort of nettlesome for the Republicans. I think he's probably going to come up with a tax reform package that's going to pick up on a lot of the ideas that were thrown out recently by the Deficit Reduction Commission. Things like do away with the deductibility of mortgage interest on second homes, not on first homes, but on second homes, or maybe homes over $500,000 in value. Things that will sort of rekindle some of that anti-fat cat zeal and please his Democratic base, but in a clever sort of way.
Does he have to go after some of those fat cat opportunities?
It wouldn't hurt him. And if any,
would you support some of them?
I would support personally a good chunk of the things that were in the Deficit Commission, assuming they became a little bit more robust. Let's be honest and blunt and straightforward with the American people. Social Security retirement age has to go up. Period. End of story. The system can't survive without it. Medicare and Medicaid, we have to do something, quite frankly, better than Obamacare to fix that entitlement. So, and as far as the tax code is concerned, the president that successfully kind of permanently fixes the American tax code, which I believe is actually one of the most debilitating things in America right now. It is a tax system unable to raise the funds and to work the economy in a fashion that actually works for the country.
Congressman Davis, do you agree that when you're looking at the sacred cows and Social Security is sitting there, that maybe changing the retirement age is one of the things that really must happen?
Well, you know, we've been very fortunate in terms of health advances in this country, and the quality of life has improved tremendously. People are living longer, but not only are they living longer, they're living better. I mean, you see people, I'm 65, I don't have any need to retire, right? As a matter of fact, I feel fine. I go to work every day, I get up every day, you know, I work 12, 13 hours a day. So
it's good. I want to follow up on that. We do have to pause. 1-800-723-8029 from Chicago. Live, I'm Bruce Dumont. From Beverly Hills, California to Little Rock, Arkansas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border. Nice to have you with us this evening. Congressman Davis, just before the break, I had asked you the question about whether or not the retirement age should be raised. And in listening to your answer, I got the sense that you think that could happen. And maybe
I was leading
should
up.
Happen. You were just about to endorse the idea, and we had to go to a break.
So that's right.
I wanted to have you hit it out of the park here.
Well, I was leading right into that in terms of suggesting that that is certainly an idea that I can live with. Not only can I live with it, but I can also be supportive of it. And I don't think it's going to hurt. You see, I think that we've reached a point where this whole business of what to do with one's time is becoming part of the conversation in America, and that there are a lot of people who are not doing enough, as far as I'm concerned, with their time. So I can go for that. Now, in terms of tax reform, I do believe in something called fair share. I mean, that is, those who have the most, I think, have to pay and should pay their fair share. So some of the sacred cows, I don't have a problem going
what
after.
What does fair share mean?
Well, fair share might mean if you've got a tax exemption on your basic living quarters, fine. But if you've got a summer home, you know, worth $2 million mm-hmm. out on the ocean side, then maybe you don't exempt that.
What do you think of that, Bruno? Because that was something John mentioned earlier. Could you support that?
In exchange for lower marginal rates? Absolutely. What we need in this country is a flat, stable, simple tax system that everybody understands, that is not gamed by a bunch of tax lawyers who know what they're doing, but where the poor or the middle class who don't have access to that kind of knowledge have no idea what's going on. So anything that gets rid of tax subsidies in exchange for lower rates, we've got to get way below 35%.
That's not something that's likely to happen in the next couple of years.
I think, Bruce, bringing it back to Social Security, one obvious way to make it more progressive, more fair, would be to do away with the ceiling on earnings on the payroll tax. What is it now? About, you know, $115,000. If you make over that, that doesn't count toward your Social Security contribution. Well, it should. They should do away with the FICA ceiling.
Danny, when obviously you have been back since the control has changed, what is the mood right now in Congress, especially from those on the Democratic side who are now in the minority in the House?
Try and figure out how to get back to the majority. let me just tell you. I mean, all of the conversation about civility, and I think it's all wonderful because I've always operated that way. Technically, I think for the next 2 years, we're going to have absolute warfare. I think that is ideological warfare, and so I don't mean, you know, the other stuff. What I'm saying is that the next 2 years are going to be very political because all eyes are on the big prize. Who's going to be the president? Who's going to get elected president? Republicans are trying desperately to figure out how do they gain control of the Senate and elect a president so that they can have pretty smooth sailing getting their thoughts and ideas hopes and aspirations.
But in the House where there was a thrashing, I mean, a lot of Democrats, you know, lost their jobs. The Republicans that went there, many with the backing of the Tea Party, they have a very clear set of goals. They are going to be measured, I believe, by the people that sent them there harshly in 2 years if they don't deliver on something. So what is the lesson that the Democrats have learned? Is it only to try to get their old jobs back and their seats back?
No, but we got to keep them from delivering on dismantling some of what I think were very positive gains that have been made.
The health care.
I mean, I was so pleased the other day that I got an assignment on oversight and government reform to be the ranking member of the subcommittee that's going to deal with health care as one of the components of it, because I think we've made some progress. And dismantling the health care, when people start talking about doing certain things to Medicare and Medicaid, which I think was the best thing that happened to health care since the Indians discovered cornflakes, especially if you were poor and old and sick and didn't have any way to get to the doctor. So those are some areas I think we're going to have knockdown, drag out discussions and fights about.
Bruno, you're going to be on the other side of this fight.
Probably. And Barack Obama has no choice but to do – he has to at least succeed in appearing to move to the center if he wants to win re-election. And the Republicans have a tough issue because they have to appear to work together on something somewhere so that they don't look like defeating Barack Obama is the only thing that they're doing. The American people don't want to see – I mean, they'll be more than happy to pick sides in the fight in an election. But if they see somebody obstructing a positive idea or something that's popular – for political gain 2 years out, they're probably going to end up punishing that party, whoever that might be. So there's benefit, and it worked for Bill Clinton, and it worked for the Republicans in 1994.
In talking about some areas where Republicans and Democrats might be able to agree, in his preview of the State of the Union, President Obama had almost a Sputnik moment, calling on American citizens to sort of recapture the spirit of American exceptionalism and to rise to the challenge of new global economic forces like China and India. And he's going to unveil his full vision for this, winning the future, as he's calling it, Tuesday night. But will the Republican-controlled Congress really fund this vision? And is there Republican buy-in to any part of this? Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was on Fox News Sunday today, and he warned against the president's investment-oriented agenda.
With all due respect to our Democratic friends, anytime they want to spend, they call it investment. So I think you'll hear the president talk about investing a lot Tuesday night. We'll take a look at his recommendations. We always do. But this is not a time to be looking at pumping up government spending in very many areas.
Government spending or investment?
I think the president's going to go hard again on infrastructure, and it'll be called investment. But I think when you look at, for instance, the new Republican governors of Wisconsin and Ohio refusing to accept money for high-speed rail improvements in their states, it shows you the rabid anti-spending ethic that's out there among the Tea Party and far right shade folks. I just think that they're going to stonewall this. They're actually trying to claw back stimulus funding for infrastructure. They're just rabidly anti-spending.
But do you see that? What is the difference between spending and investment, Congressman?
Well, I think it all sort of goes together. I mean, if you've developed a philosophy and you've got a policy that says, we've got to reduce the size of government at all costs, and we've got to reduce the deficit at all costs. Now, trying to make the distinction between how do you invest in such a way that you're in a position to reduce the deficit and also maintain a decent quality of life in the process of doing so, I think the anti-spending philosophy is going to permeate the actions of the Republicans in Congress. But
my point is, isn't that in reaction to what happened in November? And isn't that what at least people should be hearing from the public? Is that, you know, whether they call it investment or they call it spending, they don't want the government to spend more money, certainly on new programs, and they think half of the programs are duplicates, and the other half don't work at all.
And it's very simple. One man's investment is another man's pork. Take high speed rail for an example. You've got Republicans who have connections with municipal bond dealers and all the bonding agencies that want to make all the money off of this. They love the idea of high speed rail, but then you've got Democratic constituencies where they're going to be spending a lot of money that takes away from other sources, that the other things that might help Democratic constituencies, like actually getting a better education or getting more L stops or something like that. So everybody who wants to talk about investment and infrastructure, when in fact you really ought to say, what do we really need in this country? If high-speed rail is such a good idea, if it's a good idea, then the private industry, if there's a market for it, it'll fund it. But just to build a high-speed rail system so that a bunch of union people can have a bunch of jobs and say we created jobs for a rail system that no one's going to ride, light rail in all over the place is underutilized.
But in discussions of competitiveness, of making sure that the American student and the American worker is competitive with workers around the world, things that we as a country should all agree with, is that the type of thing where there could be some compromise between whether you're conservative, Republican, or liberal Democrats? You know, you may have to go home and sell it to your respective constituencies, but the reality is that not something good for the collective country?
If you're a politician, you want to deliver to your constituents what you suggested to them you were going to do.
Or you want to go down fighting for it.
Am I correct?
That's almost second best, right?
Without a doubt.
To win is best, to put up a good fight and have all your constituents know you put up a good fight, that's a pretty close second.
If Tea Party has got me into Congress, I'm going to try to deliver for Tea Party.
Right. And that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. 1-800-723-8289. We got callers on the line. When we come back, 1-800-723-8289 from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Around the table this evening, we have Congressman Danny Davis in his 14th year representing the West Side and portions of downtown Chicago and Western Suburbia in Congress, a longtime Democrat, also a former county board member, longtime alderman in the city of Chicago, one of the leading political figures in the city of Chicago. And I mentioned in the last segment that he was on the House Ways and Means Committee. He used to be, just got off of that in the last couple of weeks. He's now on Homeland Security. And also, as he said in the first segment, he's now on a new subcommittee on the Government Oversight Committee, and that will look into Medicare. He will be the ranking Democrat on the Medicare-related issues. So he will be a major player in the debate that will go on. For those Republicans that want to dismantle Obamacare, they're going to have to get by Danny K. Davis. Bruno Barron also joins us. He is our Republican. He is with the Heartland Institute. That is a libertarian think tank. He is director of the Center for Education Reform. And old friend John McCarron joins us, longtime reporter for about 27 years, reporter and columnist for the Chicago Tribune, recently switching as an adjunct professor of journalism. He was spreading all of his wisdom to the journalists of the future at DePaul University. Always nice to have you with us on our program.
Bruce, quickly, could I just say, you know, sure. DePaul's really got a journalism program. Now, you know, we get lots of interns now in journalism and fellows and all of that from DePaul. You know, it used to always be someplace else.
Yeah, Loyola has a program. Columbia has a program. So we have a lot of journalists. Journalism is changing, and what they need to know is a lot different. But, yeah, it's not just Northwestern's Medill School anymore.
We should also mention, for those people around the United States who do not know of your congressional district, it includes a great number of universities. Do you want to mention
all
a few of
those? All
of
those universities that were just mentioned. Paul, as a matter of fact,
Roosevelt, Columbia, University of Illinois.
South Loop is an education mecca in and of itself. I mean, just wonderful. Columbia College, yeah, I mean, all of them, they're just there. Spertus, East-West University, right. Robert Morris.
See, and John should have guys from Heartland come out on healthcare and education and talk to those journalists about where they could go for a free market view on some of these issues instead of just calling up the school superintendent and say, well, should we increase spending? Oh, yeah, okay, fine, and then and report that we should increase spending.
Speaking of that, let's go to calls. Let's go to Chris on WLS Radio, and she is calling from Palatine, Illinois. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, Bruce. Did you use a feminine plural of pronoun?
What?
Did you say he or she? I'm sorry.
No, I said Chris.
Okay, great. Yeah, well, anyway.
I wasn't sure.
I have a very simple way that...
I might have. My producer just said I might have done that.
Okay,
so
I was going to say, I haven't done any sex change operations
yet. It's one of those names that, you know...
Yeah, I understand. Unisex. I have a simple way that Obama can immediately cut the federal budget. That's something that every Republican will stand up and applaud and support because it is exactly what George Bush and the Republicans did from 2002 to 2008, which is take the Iraq and Afghanistan wars off budget, and therefore we've cut the budget by, what, $100, $150, $200 billion a year? Very simple, you know. And again, the Republicans cannot complain about this because that was something that Bush did, and they, when they were in the majority in the House and Senate, hardly went along with.
Still have to be paid for, though.
Still, even if it's
We're talking different things. I mean, the Bush administration never paid for the drug benefit that he gave to the Medicare patients, did he? He just put that off,
Bruno.
Too.
Chris, your cleverness is surpassed only by your irony. I mean, the fact is that we need to have much more government spending transparency. Nothing should be off budget. Everything should be
Bruno,
marked.
Where were you 6 years ago? Where were you 10 years ago when the Bush administration and the Republicans were doing this? I didn't hear the right-wing Republican Party just jumping up and down and screaming and yelling and demanding transparency.
But that's actually not true. There were many, many conservatives.
Nobody in Congress.
That's not true. They had to hold the hearings open for the Medicare vote or the vote open for Medicare for Part D. And there's a lot of people that were angry about it. And it wasn't, you know, Bush's low poll numbers for the last few years of his presidency was based on a collapse of support from a lot of conservatives. So that's just not fair.
Well, I also think the other way, the other major thing we should do is immediately reduce the FICA taxes, maybe knock 4 points off, 2 points off the employee, 2 points off the employer, and raise the limit to unlimited. I agree with Mr. Davis, Congressman Davis, excuse me. And likewise, we should define income more broadly. So, for example, all the money that these hedge fund managers are making, instead of it being considered capital gains, should be regular income. And I doubt very much if these people who are being paid $1 billion a year are going to let a little thing like a couple of extra points of taxes stop them from taking that money.
All right, listen, thanks very much for your call. Congressman, one of the things that's gotten a lot of play is the fact that in the wake of this shooting of Congresswoman Giffords, that on Tuesday night, Republicans are going to sit with Democrats in a spirit of at least friendship. Who are you going to sit with, and is that important at all,
or is it just
a feel-good story?
Well, it's both. I mean, symbolism is, in fact, very important. Every bill that I've gotten passed, and I've been very fortunate, I've actually passed a number of bills, you know, source bills, actual bills, you know, things that relate to the whole country. But in every instance, I've always had a Republican co-sponsor, and our relationship came in many instances as a result of civil interaction. I noticed the football season is upon us, and Coach Osborne, Nebraska, who used to win all of the championships when he was in Congress, we both served on the Education Committee. And we just kind of noticed in dialogue and conversation that we agreed or saw things a lot of similar ways. And so we ended up putting a bill together called the Campus Care Counseling Act, because we both felt that youngsters needed some more help. And that kind of ultimately got it passed. I mean, unfortunately, we had 3 members of Congress whose children committed suicide that year. But we got the legislation passed. It became law. We went to the White House. The president signed it. Colleges and universities began to get more money to deal with mental health issues and problems. And that's just one example where the relationship that we had kind of brought us together to do this. And so I think it's meaningful. But I think we've got to go beyond the symbolism, though, and actually have relationships.
What is your relationship with Speaker Boehner?
Oh, I was about to say John, but let me just say Speaker Boehner, who was chairman of education at that time. And so we have a relationship. I mean, we you know, when I meet him in the hall or whatever, he's, Danny, how you doing? Yeah, Mr. Speaker, what's going on? I need to come see you, whatever. So I think that these relationships do, in fact, develop. And when they do, it adds another possibility to getting some things done.
Because you come from one of the most Democratic districts in the United States, as a Democrat, can you walk further down the road towards a Republican idea? Because you're really not going to be punished for it back home. And thus, does Republican leadership view you as a Democrat from the district you have as one who's more open to ideas than someone who is in a more competitive district that if they go too far the chain's going to be pulled.
Well, I think there is a feeling that if you're in a certain kind of district, you can do what you simply decide. For example, when Speaker Hastert was the Speaker of the House.
Also a friend of yours.
Also a friend of mine. And we got the American Community Renewal and New Markets Initiative Act passed during his tenure. And, of course, Jim Talent, who went on to the Senate, Jim and I and J.C. Watts were the principal sponsors of that legislation. We worked on it 2 or 3 years together and eventually got it done. I was instrumental in getting the president to say, okay, I'm for it and with it. And they got the Republican committee and, you know, and Speaker Hastert, and it worked.
Bruce, I'm being swept by waves of nostalgia listening to the congressman, because it's all true, New Markets Initiative, great, but it scares the heck out of me when I see people like Dick Armey writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal says, well, the first thing we have to do is get rid of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I mean, get rid of it. Never mind the programs like New Markets. I mean, there's just a new era out there. And I appreciate what the congressman is saying. I just see gridlock coming here. And maybe that's probably the best the Democrats can do is gridlock.
Joe in Gurnee, Illinois, has got a good question. Go ahead, Joe. Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here now.
But go ahead.
The third rail of election politics has always been Social Security. But I think now is the time when you can means test it, and means test it gently enough that you can get rid of a lot of this debt and deficit that it dumps on the economy. That's you've had a change in the demographics. The people that are now moving into retirement are not so dependent upon Social Security as they once were.
I want to talk about that. We're about to go into a break, and I know that Bruno and Congressman Davis and John all have want to comment on that. So we'll talk about the issue of means testing when we come back. Thanks very much for being with us. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight we're talking, giving a little preview to the President's State of the Union Address, which will take place on Tuesday night. And Congressman Danny Davis, a member of Congress, is with us this evening, taking your calls at 1-800-723-8029. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Before the break, we had a caller that asked opinions of everybody. We'll start with Congressman Davis on the issue of means testing, whether that is an important thing that has got to be on the table for the reforms that many feel are needed.
Well, I've got mixed feelings about it. I mean, Social Security, of course, you've worked, you've earned, you've put in. You've invested. It's yours. Yet, on the other hand, you know, if I'm a trillionaire, you know, I really could live without.
You could scrape by without it.
But, yeah. But as soon as you means test Social Security, it becomes a welfare program. I mean, small W welfare. I think it would make much more sense to just take the limit off the wages that you can earn, where the tax stops, and let it go to unlimited earnings.
Well, and so that's been said 3 or 4 times now, and somebody ought to say something about it. It's amazing to me. Now, we just saw what I guess my friends at the table here would think was a small tax increase here in Illinois, where income tax went from 3 to 5%. And for that simple tax increase there, you're looking at $1,600 for a family that makes has a $48,000 or $52,000 a year adjusted gross income. These things have an impact, and if someone's making $125,000 a year, and you just lift that cap, you've just given them a 6.5% tax increase, which is less money for them to invest, less money for them to spend on a vacation or remodeling or something. And this is the problem with liberalism. It's so easy to sit there and say, well, we'll just tax that and we'll give a program over here, and they never want to look at the other side of that equation: the number of jobs that are destroyed, the number of people who can't hire the next person, the number of people who can't do the next buy that washing machine or maybe not get the new car or maybe not do something for their children. And it's just like, oh, well, the rich will pay. Here's the problem. It's become way too unstable. If you look at California and the American government, the federal government, a progressive tax system the way we have now is far too unstable. It cannot meet the needs of the culture, of the society, when there's a downturn. It's time to flatten out the tax code and get a little bit more from everybody instead of this, oh, let's just tax the rich.
Mike in Spokane, Washington, listening to us on KXLY. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, thanks, Bruce, and Happy New Year, and I'm sorry about the Bears.
Well, listen, I'm sorry about your Seattle Seahawks, too. We beat them.
Yeah, that's right. You beat us pretty good. That's right. Well, a couple of things here. First of all, I know people, I wasn't going to talk about Social Security, but I know people whose only income, they survive on Social Security. And by the time the 20th of the month comes, that's all they have to live on. I just thought I'd bring that up.
No one's suggesting taking that away.
No. Okay. And you're right. That involves a lot. But you were called on another issue, right?
I did, Bruce. Yeah. Today, there's 3 points I'd like to make. Unemployment is at 9.6%, and some benefits have ended. Number two, the defense military. Sometimes I think on military, President Obama is in Alice in Wonderland. Up is down, and down is up. Communist China imprisoned the Nobel Peace Prize winner. They imprisoned religious descendants. They imprisoned Catholic bishops and other religious. Their military is growing. And the third point is President Obama supports abortion on demand. We have now over 1 million abortions.
John McCarron.
Well, I
think any one of those topics.
Point number two, as far as attitudes toward communist China, I was watching some C-SPAN this week, and it was a House Foreign Relations Committee, and you talk about bipartisanship. One after another, every member of that committee took a hammer to Hu Jintao. He was this, he's that, they're this and they're that. So I'm not sure whether this is a good thing that they're piling on the Chinese, given the fact that they own so much of our debt. But
and he was also in the president who was in Chicago this week, actually less than a mile from where we are doing this broadcast from, the mayor of Chicago, saying that Chicago wants to be the most China-friendly city in the United States.
That's Big Bash.
Were you there?
I did not go, but I certainly had an invitation, but I was traveling back and forth and didn't get here in time to really go.
For those people who are not on the inside, Congressman, when they see all, and I will use the fat cats, you know, the people that get invited to these events, it's all about business, and nobody ever talks about human rights. And yet, when many of those people, if they're politicians, they will go back to their districts and they'll talk about the importance of human rights. But when it comes right down to it, they would sell out their mother if they could get a deal for their district. Isn't that true?
Well,
or their company?
Well, again, it's symbolism. It's civility. I mean, part of it is kind of what you do. You got to display.
Wouldn't some people call it BS as well?
Well, there's a lot of that that goes on.
Well, I mean, it's like you're sitting there and nobody wants to bring up issues of human rights.
As a matter of fact, in those kind of environments, generally, and I've done so sometimes, and people kind of get a little quiet at that moment.
Right.
I mean, I will oftentimes, when I'm even talking with dignitaries or business people about a certain issue, I will slip in the issue of what's going on with incarcerated people and do you hire them when they come out and that kind of thing. And a lot of times people, this is totally off topic, but right. I do it anyway.
Because it's important to you.
It's important to me. Right. And I think people try and be civil and they don't raise these issues in the social thing very much.
In polite circles, you don't bring up embarrassing questions,
yeah.
Especially when there's big business.
It's never a bad time to make a dictator uncomfortable.
Right. Just and the congressman is the national authority on ex-offenders and reentry.
And when we come back in the next hour, we're going to talk a little bit about that because that was one of the projects that Congressman Davis worked on with President Bush. That was a bipartisan thing they worked on. We'll talk a little bit about what that means. And also, it sort of is one of those projects that perhaps a lot of people think is a waste of money. And we're going to find out why, at least in Congressman Davis's position, he doesn't believe that's the case. And we'll let everybody respond and give their thoughts. We'll all be back in the next hour for another full hour of Beyond the Beltway, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border. Phone lines remain open, 1-800-723-8289. This is live Beyond the Beltway every Sunday night from Chicago, and I'm Bruce Dumont. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, tonight featuring commentary by Democratic Congressman Danny K. Davis, longtime representative of the 7th District of Illinois, Republican Bruno Behrend of the Heartland Institute, and journalist and professor John McCarron from DePaul University, longtime journalist with the Chicago Tribune. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. We continue our conversation. In the first hour, we talked a little bit about the preview of the President's State of the Union address that is coming up Tuesday night, and I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about the specifics of that next week, although he gave a little preview on YouTube, and so we spent a little bit of time talking about that. One key element that those who have gone to Washington in the wake of the Tea Party explosion in the country. They are going to be looking for ways to cut the budget, to cut spending. They have serious questions about the country's deficit, the debt. And this morning on Meet the Press, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor of Virginia indicated that Republicans will make Democrats give concessions before they budge on their plan to fight increasing the debt limit.
Republicans are not going to vote for this increase in the debt limit unless there are serious spending cuts and reforms.
Like what?
I mean, that is just the way it is, okay?
Right.
So we have talked a lot about bringing spending levels down to 08 levels. We've talked about things that we can do to make sure that off into the future, this kind of spending doesn't continue.
That was Eric Cantor, and again, I want to spend the rest of at least a portion of this next hour talking about such in the medical plan, the Obamacare. But I want to spend a few moments talking about the issue of cuts, because so much of the Republican political agenda is about cutting, is to cut programs back to levels of 2008. But my question to you, Congressman, because you've been a member, you've been down there for 14 years now. It's difficult to make cuts on anything because there are political constituencies that are tied to every line item. But as a member of Congress and your colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats, maybe more Republicans that really want to go in and cut some of those programs, how do you personally, what criteria do you use to determine what is a successful program and what is a failure? And what is perhaps duplicative?
Well, Bruce, let me tell you my philosophy about cut, 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 cut. If all you do is cut, 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 all you get is blood, 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 blood. And so there's going to be a lot of bleeding. And you don't like to see some of the bleeding. And, of course, if people bleed too long, they die. If institutions bleed too long, if programs bleed too long, if concepts bleed too long, they also die. Now, many of the things that exist in our society evolved. I mean, we thought as they were evolving that they made sense. Otherwise, people would not have done it. Let me just give the president some real credit in terms of the movement that we've seen in Iraq and the movement of combat troops coming out of there. When we said we were going to reduce our engagement, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's all of the military action is a lot of money. All of the defense action is a lot of money. So, when I think of places to find cuts, I look at military. I look at some of the defense. I look at some of the esoteric evolutionary exploration of things that we are engaged in more so than I do the programmatic life-saving, life-serving.
But isn't the big question here is, what is really life-saving? What is really important? And there are 435 members of the House, and they all want to be able to say that they brought something back to their district. They wouldn't be doing something if they didn't think there was some benefit to someone. Maybe it's, you know, maybe some would say, you know, it's benefit to the congressman, but in this particular case, it is a benefit to a district. Let's take one program that I would like to dissect a little bit, and I would like to ask my colleagues to join me in this sort of dissecting of something that is near and dear to your heart. The 7th District of Illinois has one of the largest populations of ex-offenders in the United States. John McCarron, in the last segment, he gave you a bouquet for your leadership in dealing with the issue of what happens when someone is released from prison. How do you get them back on the right track so they don't go back in prison again and cost everybody a lot more money? And you have been a leader in that. It's also a position that or a situation that you were able to engage President Bush, who embraced your plan. It was a bipartisan plan. But tell the voters listening all over the country who don't live in the 7th Congressional District of Illinois, why, with all the things that the government should do, why should there be a program that tries to get people who have violated our laws, who've been in prison, why should we help them when they get out of prison as opposed to using that money to help a child at the beginning of their education career?
Because in many instances, Bruce, when we help them, we're actually helping ourselves. The reality is that we are the most incarcerated nation, the most imprisoned nation in the world. There's nobody who imprisons as many people as we do proportionately or in actual numbers. I mean, we got more people in prison than China. I mean, than
India. Over 2 million.
Yeah, more than 2 million. I mean, and they're costing us money. I mean, serious money. In some instances, we're paying as much as $70,000 a year just to keep some of these people confined. And that's all taxpayer money. So if we can find a way to help these individuals, some of them, become self-sufficient when they come out of prison so that they don't go back to work, get a job, contribute to society, stop doing whatever it was that got them in there in the first place, then we help all of society.
Conceptually, Bruno Barron, conservative Republican, is that a worthy program for the federal government to be involved in?
If I'm looking through a very long straw and looking at that specific program, and I'm seeing what it does, and I'm noticing that it has positive metrics and it actually works, I'm going to say it's a worthwhile program. But let me ask everybody else, Congressman Davis included, to take away that very long, thin straw looking at that one program. And let's look at the education in Chicago, for example. Let's look at a massive bureaucracy that employs all kinds of people but is basically a 50-60% dropout factory. Will Congressman Davis let us reallocate the resources so that the money starts following the child and not the bureaucracy, which is part of the problem of all those incarcerated kids? We need to reorganize and look
part
at everything,
the,
not just
part of the problem.
Part of the problem.
I want to get John's response, and I want to get the audience response to this as well. Let's spend a little more time just looking at this one particular program and finding out whether it works and whether or not it continues should be funded. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. John McCarron from DePaul University, longtime columnist for the Chicago Tribune, joins us. And, John, I wanted you to weigh in on this sort of this anatomy of this federal program on dealing with incarcerated people as they come out.
Getting back to ex-offenders, I do a lot of freelance writing lately for about groups on the West Side in the Congressman's district, places like Garfield Park and Lawndale and whatnot. And it's amazing, you know, working with foundations charitable foundations and community organizations. They're able to set up programs where ex-offenders, can get jobs. Having to put down that they're an ex-offender on their application isn't a deal killer right there, because everybody knows they're an ex-offender. And got them doing community gardens, got them doing home weatherization and whatnot. And the government has got to be there. I mean, the foundations are there, the community organizations are there as well. But the government's got to be there with a little something to make these programs go, a salary or two.
What does the government, in this particular program that you worked on, Danny, what exactly does the program do?
In many instances, it provides funding for organizations like those John talked about, so that people are there who can help and facilitate and provide some resource and movement for these individuals. In some instances, though, it tries to help get rid of barriers. I mean,
so the ex-offender does not the ex-offender is not receiving any direct money.
Oh, none.
They're receiving training?
Assistance, training, in some instances.
Preparation. Preparation for a new life.
With anger management. In some instances, it's also a look at the systems of what got them where they were and where they are, and how do we keep them from re-entering back into those systems. There are barriers that are unbelievable in terms of things that individuals who have criminal backgrounds are barred in many instances.
Such as?
Licensure. I mean, we just got some movement on being able to cut hair. I mean, you couldn't be a barber. I mean, you could not get a license to cut hair. You cannot work,
for example. Drive a school bus, maybe.
You can't drive a school bus. You can't do that unless you get a waiver. You can't work in any health facility at all in the state of Illinois unless you get, I'm talking about, you can't cut the grass on a hospital yard. I mean, you can't fix the toilet. You can't, unless you can get a waiver. And then there are all kinds of professions. You can't be a plumber. I mean, you can't do anything almost.
Bruce, can I just jump in here? And this is a perfect example of how a libertarian or a conservative or a free market solution answers these kinds of questions and fixes them. What are we doing licensing hairdressers? I got an idea. If a hairdresser wants to say, hey, here's my shingle, I'm going to cut your hair, and they're a lousy hairdresser because they cut your hair badly, they're not going to be a hairdresser very much longer. We don't need to be licensing hairdressers. We don't need to be licensing lawnmowers, people who mow lawns. I mean, the whole North Shore is full of Mexicans who don't have lawn cutting licenses. So there's a whole mindset that goes on here, and quite frankly, and I don't know. I'd love to be involved in talking about some solutions for this stuff, because I'll give you an idea. You want to teach a prisoner how to never be unemployed and how to make money for the rest of his life while he's in prison? Let him take an entrepreneurship class. Let him learn how to start a business. He'll never have to go begging for a job again.
What can people do, Danny?
Get a license.
Well, let's get rid of occupational licensing.
Going back to you were very specific there. So really, the job opportunities are very, very small, based on what you've said.
Well, I think
in many cases, as they come out of prison, they may not have the skills even to properly train themselves or even fill out a resume. And then what happens again? This program that you have going, the minute the person puts down on an application that they're an ex-offender, isn't that an automatic end of the job interview?
For many companies and businesses and opportunities, that's a killer right there, right then and there. There was an effort, and it actually got passed in both the House and the Senate in the Illinois legislature, where individuals would not have to do that. Of course, it was a bill that State Representative LaShawn Ford got passed in the House, but the former governor vetoed it, because the State's Attorneys Associations, the Retail Merchants Associations, all of these groups lobby against that kind of legislative action.
Now, you talked about that America is the most incarcerated nation in the country. And historically, whether it is the state of Illinois or any state, one of the things that lawmakers from rural or smaller communities would always get out of the internal political dealing within that state is they would get a prison guards, and the prison industrial complex is a part of small town America in 50 states. That's where you send the people from the largest city to get them away from the people, and they get incarcerated. And it is a jobs program that is perpetuated, which is also one of the reasons why, on the other end of the coin, you have people who want to send people to prison for long periods of time at great costs, because it's a jobs program. It isn't so much about punishing. It's about punishing people, yes, but and what's happening in the penal system now is you have the privatization of prisons. So sending people to prison for a long period of time, or for doing crimes that maybe could best be served with you know, monitoring of some sort, it's a jobs program.
Well, what you're saying is true, and I know Reverend Jesse Jackson has said over and over again, he may have coined the expression the prison industrial complex, but I don't think that's a motive on the part of people in downstate Illinois. I don't think they vote for
no.
Lock them up and throw them away because they need the jobs. I think if we want to
But that's what they always got out of the deal. The final deals that were put together, that's why so many prisons in Illinois are built on that highway from Chicago to Springfield.
A distasteful symbiosis, yeah, between the rural and the urban. I like Bruno's idea of backing up and looking at the larger problem. And here I think it's a matter of the way this country deals with drugs. Rather than use the criminal system and the prison system, I think we got to bite the bullet, go for legalization on many of these substances, and deal with it as a medical issue.
We got a caller coming in, by the way, who wants to pick up on that. Dan, calling from Chicago, you want to pick up on the drug issue?
Yeah, I sure do. Fellow libertarian on this end of the line, and to that extent, I fault both Democrats and Republicans because it seems neither party has either the courage or the desire to address this issue. We've been fighting the drug war since the 70s. There is absolutely no sign whatsoever that we are even close to winning this war, and there's not even a foreseeability that we're winning the war. Why do we take a young lady? I'll give you an example. And this is not just an anecdotal evidence. This is pretty common. A young lady, she gets a degree at a junior college level. She has some kids. She's not getting help from the father of her kids. And she's talked into doing some quick drug sales where she can make a lot of money, cash, really fast. Doesn't think about it too seriously. She's got desperate straits going. She does it. She doesn't realize she gets caught. Maybe it's an undercover agent. Who knows what the situation is? Well, these defined minimum sentencing laws are very draconian. And we end up shipping her off to places like Dwight for a minimum of 4 years or 5 years. Her kids, of course, they lose because they don't have the benefit of being with their mother. And now, by the time she gets out, she's a convicted felon. You keep using the word offender, rehabilitation.
Convicted felon.
Does she really need rehabilitation for a mistake of that nature? She can't get a job. She went to, I'll tell you the rest of the story. I'll be done in 30 seconds. She goes to Walmart. She applies for the job. She lies on her application, says she's never been convicted of a crime. 4 months later, the manager comes in the office and says, we have to talk about something. He knew what it was. He says, you found out about it. Says, yes, we did. So she says, well, let me ask you this question. He says, if I hadn't lied on the application, would you have hired me? He says, no. Okay. Starting to get my point?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Three strikes and you're out, mandatory minimums. All of these things contribute significantly to our prison system, and there's a tremendous need for reform.
for the last 8 years at the Tribune, I was on the editorial board and had the pleasure of sitting across the desk every morning with Steve Chapman, a libertarian. And I always say, Steve, you're like that stopwatch. You're right twice a day on legalization of drugs, number one, and avoiding foreign wars, number two.
Well, I think he was right on tax increases and spending and a lot of other things as well.
Just twice a day.
The legalization argument, the caller has a very good point. We can't be taking people like this and making them criminals for these kinds of things. And there are some – I'm on the fence on legalization, but it's clearly something that needs to be looked at in terms of where we're throwing people away. I will say this one thing.
But also, go ahead.
I just want to say this one thing. If people are doing bad things and they're a danger to society, we need to figure out a way so that we get people to stop doing bad things. But putting people in jail because they're a danger to society is in and of itself not a bad thing. Let's fix the problem at the front end, but bad people should be in jail. I'd rather have them than out in the streets.
You won't get an argument from us.
Right. However, depending on what the crime is, there are ways in which they could be monitored with electronic devices for far less dollars. I'm looking at the economic of
absolutely.
It as well. So society would be protected, and it would cost us less money to do it. I want to talk more about those reforms when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Bruno Behrend is here. He is our Republican. He is with the Heartland Institute, where he is the director of the Center for Educational Reform. Also has done some talk radio work over the years. He's also an attorney.
Right.
But you don't practice. Is that correct?
I practice a little bit. I sued the Secretary of State and the Attorney General on horrible contract language. And I sued a school district for trying to keep people off the ballot that they didn't want to run
against. From Lake Forest, Illinois, right?
Right.
Originally from Lake Forest. John McCarron also joins us for 27 years. He was a writer, reporter, and columnist for the Chicago Tribune. His area of expertise is urban affairs, one of the best in the country. He is now a teacher of journalism at DePaul University. Always a good friend to be with us, one of our favorite progressives who joins this program. And he proudly wears the label of journalist and progressive, and he does it proudly, and he doesn't pretend like he's not progressive.
Well, I'm a columnist. I get to be progressive.
Well, that's good.
When
I know, but you know, some of your colleagues do that when they're reporting, too. Also, joining us this evening is Congressman Danny Davis. For 14 years, he has represented the 7th District of Illinois, which is in the western suburban and most of the many portions of the downtown Chicagoland area, which includes many of the great universities. And yes, it is where I live, and it is where I work, and it is where the museum is. So as many of the other great museums in the 7th Congressional District. And again, we've been we should mention for those listening around the country, up until about a month ago, Congressman was seriously considering and was a candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago. And he decided to drop out. And my question to you, why did you do that? Because I know you have run for mayor of the city of Chicago before. You would like to be mayor of the city of Chicago. And for a couple of months, you really wanted to do it, but you backed away. Why?
You know, being a politician and getting elected, all of this is very philosophical and very ideological, but there are also some practical aspects to it. And if you find that you're fishing in the same pond, and you got to have a catch big enough to balance the catch that somebody else may have coming from another pond. And you make a decision. And I made a decision that there were a lot of candidates seriously fishing in the primary pond that I was fishing in for votes.
And money.
Especially and money. And decided that I'd give them greater opportunity, that I would give at least one of them greater opportunity to be successful. And that's why I decided that I would get out and support Kara Mosley-Braun. Mm-hmm.
Congressman, for those listening around the country, you and I have known each other for probably 25 or 30 years. You were a man that came out of the communities. You were a community activist. You were a reformer. Then you became a member of the Chicago City Council, and from the City Council you went to the County Board, Congress for 14 years. So we have known each other when you were sort of the rhetorical bomb thrower from the outside. You were one of the original panel members on our previous show, Inside Politics, along with Rahm Emanuel, I might say, and Luis Gutierrez, who went on to Congress as well. So you've spent a lot of your life on the outside. You've spent the last 20-plus years sort of at least as a member, as an elected member of Congress and the City Council. What's the big change? What's the significant change from the Danny Davis of 25 years ago to the Danny Davis of today?
Well, I think the only change that I really have seen, Bruce, is that I have a better understanding of how these processes work and how different. I mean, there are things that I just simply expect of people in terms of their positions, because you learn that in so many instances, where people stand really depends upon where they sit. And that there is a big difference between being an advocate, where you're pretty much free and uninhibited. You do what you do. It's another task to actually represent people. And so when I take a position, I can't just take a Danny Davis position, because quite frankly, I told some people if they would vote for me, that I would represent them. And so my responsibility is to represent, at the very least, a majority of the individuals who live in the 7th Congressional District and give me a contract every 2 years to go to Washington and represent them.
In the last segment, we talked about your leadership in this federal legislation that deals with those who are incarcerated, who are now coming out, trying to get their lives back together again. It was bipartisan. Was it overwhelmingly, did you have strong Republican support? I know the President Bush was a strong supporter, but were there a lot of Republicans that jumped on this program that we've been talking about in the last segment?
No, but I had some key people. Mm-hmm. Rob Portman, for example, who's now the senator from Ohio. Rob was in the House. He also was known as being very friendly with President Bush. I mean, he was known as one of the president's best friends in the House. And Rob and I collaborated on this legislation, on this idea. And he was my key partner until he became the U.S. Trade Representative. And then I had to find other Republicans to buy in.
This program that we were talking about, that we've been discussing in the last segment, how much does this federal program cost?
Well, right now, in terms of direct funding for the Second Chance Act, it's $100 million.
Second Chance Act is the name of it.
But there are all kinds.
And again, for people that tuned in, the Second Chance Act is, again, it's got a price tag of $100 million.
Right.
And it works in all 50 states. And it works with foundations and community groups that try to provide training and assistance to those incarcerated as when they get out, so that they go into a more productive life and not get bogged down and end up going back into prison. And
colleges and universities, state departments of correction. I mean, all of these individuals who work with criminal justice kinds of issues can apply for resources. But in addition to that, it does some other things. For example, the Attorney General has just convened the first coordinated meeting of all of the cabinet heads. That's a part of them working cooperatively and working together to see what solutions can be found. That is the Secretary of Education, the Secretary of
Health. On this subject? To tie into this subject?
Yes, yes.
How they can participate?
That's part of the legislation. I'm saying is the establishment of a federal coordinating council to do that. The Bureau of Prisons is also, the Federal Bureau of Prisons is also greatly involved, because there are pieces of the legislation that relate to individuals who are incarcerated and what need to be done with them, and how do we really deal with this whole issue of prison reform?
Does it deal with things that are happening to prisoners while they're in prison, or does it own the second chance only start once they have been released?
No, it actually also deals with individuals while they're in prison, and there are some concepts and principles in the legislation that really suggest that when a person come to prison, you really should do a serious assessment and determine to the best of your ability what got them there. Why is this person here? And if we can make that determination and find that out, then you start working with them to try and make sure
so
that they get out, they don't come back.
To pick up on Bruno's idea, I mean, it is possible that the Commerce Department could be working on this second chance program to have the entrepreneurship programs that you were talking about.
Yeah, entrepreneurship, teach them how
to...
Is that the type of link that
you're talking about?
Exactly, and again, look for ways that this can be done where it doesn't cost a lot of money. Why not contract with Phoenix or DeVry to... right now, here in the middle of Illinois, we've got an empty prison that's been sitting around wasting money, a perfect example
Thompson.
Of the idiocy of Illinois government. Why not turn that into a little mini university? And why not put people through there that do this assessment and find out where people can come out of that with a job or a potential career? Conservatives, this is the funny thing. You know, everybody sits there and Tea Party people are just crazy. They want to cut everything. No. We're all really smart people who just sit there and say, well, show me something that works. Prove to me that it works. Prove to me that it works on paper. And, oh, by the way, you don't have to have 1,000 bureaucrats and 1,000 pensions and 1,000 things going in and back-end contracts, and we don't have to spend this much money for it. Good ideas and good concepts don't necessarily always require legislation.
But, again, when the congressman said – I will get your response. When the congressman said $100 million – I can almost imagine the hollers for people listening to this program saying, $100 million for ex-cons? I mean, that's the way they would think about it. Whereas, at least as we are discussing, and we frankly we have a little more time to discuss it than you normally do on a national program where you understand the connectivity to it, and if you are sending people to prison and you are giving them no education, no opportunities, and you let them out and they have no job opportunities and no training, don't be surprised. Don't be surprised if they're going to go back in again.
Yeah, Bruce, $100 million, that doesn't buy you a small naval vessel in today's market, number one. And two,
but it's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but let's get back to what's the cost of not doing anything, of just having people go through the revolving door of prison street.
I just think we should take the $100 million out of the CPS bureaucracy budget.
Okay.
But there are other concepts in it.
We'll talk more about when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. If you're listening in the Chicagoland area, a reminder tonight at 10:30 on WYCC Channel 20 and Comcast, our television show. We'll be doing the Inside Politics version of the broadcast this evening. And Miguel Del Valle, who is a candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago, Susana Mendoza, who's a candidate for city clerk, will be there, along with the reporters Mick Dumke, from the Chicago News Cooperative, Carol Felsenthal, a blogger for Chicago Magazine, and Robert Malaro, longtime ward committeeman and state lawmaker. Again, good, lively discussion. It's in the can, as they say, tonight at 10:30 on WYCC. Let's go to Margaret, listening to us on WLS, our flagship station in Chicago.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling regarding the incarceration topic that you've been discussing tonight.
Yeah.
I just came upon your program. I heard Danny Davis say something that makes so much sense to me. And this really, what happened to my family last August was I have a family member who was only 30 years old, but had a hard, never got a good break in his life. Had a difficult childhood because the parents, unfortunately, were a little difficult and did not give him the attention he needed, even though he was a really good kid. But that aside, one thing led to another. He ended up going to Gage Park High School, where he did not do well. He ended up having to leave that high school because it wasn't because he was smart. It was because of the gang activity. He wasn't a part of any gangs. He never had a tattoo. He ended up getting a GED, but then ended up getting a pretty wild girl pregnant. That child was given up for adoption. One thing after another, he went down a wrong path. He got picked up for having pot. He started getting little things held against him, could not get a decent job, ended up into heroin, could not get off heroin, and was picked up for having bits of drugs on him here and there, just small things. Always a good guy, never a guy who was ever mean to a woman, nothing like that. He just couldn't get things right and never got a bit of luck in his life. Last summer, he was supposed to go before a judge, and apparently he knew he was going to end up going to jail, and he walked along the railroad tracks and threw himself underneath a train and killed himself. The wheel went right across his chest, killed himself instantly, and thank God his face wasn't demolished, because I identified him down on Harrison Street. But it's just, he could not get a break, and part of it was because he had this record. And this was not a bad kid. So I just wanted to...
Well, listen, Margaret, I appreciate, I know you've been waiting a long time to share this story, and I think it's important, and it goes back to a conversation we had last week on this program when we talked about mental health in the wake of the assassination attempt on Congresswoman Giffords, and the fact that mental health is at the core of so many issues, social issues that we deal with in this country, and yet we don't spend the appropriate amount of time, in my view, talking about it. And we don't spend enough time on programs like this and other programs with far larger audiences than this to have real serious conversations about things like people who go to prison. I mean, what happens when somebody goes to prison? It isn't just right. One person being taken off the street. You know, the ripple effect is incredible. And then you get into the financial aspect of it. You get into the lost opportunities, and as you say, the opportunity to teach those who are in prison is important. Is it more important than teaching a child who starts school who has never ever committed a crime? No, it's not. But the context has got to be discussed, because it isn't just either or you're going to have one system of government, which the fastest growing at the state level, the fastest growing line item budgets in state government are prisons. The prison industrial complex.
A lot of people who should not be in there, and they throw them away like they're animals, like there's no worth. And this is for, it was for petty little things. It wasn't for, you know, burglary. He never owned a gun, nothing like that. And you know, he was, I'm sure, terrified and did not want, you know, to be locked up. And that was the decision he made.
See, Bruce,
you know?
I think.
And it was just so sad. It was just.
Okay.
As long as we have to deal with the either or, I'm saying, as opposed to dealing with the need. For example, for just a little bit of money, we could provide education opportunities for lots of people in prison. But that program was cut out. I'm saying individuals could go to prison and they could actually earn college degrees and do. And all you'd have to pay for.
Well, some skill.
Well, and
all you'd have to pay for would be the instructors, because you've already got the space.
You already got the space, and you've already got a captive audience, no pun intended. But there's another missing element here, and it bears saying whether it's a political issue or not, and that is that we all have access to grace, and we all have access to ask for it. And sometimes if you just go into a situation and say, give me a little bit of grace, you might get it.
On that note, we are out of time. I wish we had more time. Hopefully this group can come back. And again, well, this is just, when you talk about the federal budget and how many pages there are and how many line items, I mean, we just talked about one $100 million line item in the federal budget. the battle for that and what the president wants to do with the money and what the Republicans want to do with that money. That will start Tuesday night. Everybody will be able to watch the president's address. And again, we're going to be talking about, you know, when everybody says it's very, very easy to say cut, cut, cut. And certainly there is vast waste in the federal government, and things can be cut. But you've got to look at each line item and really ask yourself the ripple effect. And we spent at least a couple of segments tonight talking about one program. Congressman Danny Davis, thanks very much for being with us this evening. Bruno Barron, John McCarron, thank you all for joining us as well. This program is a Genevieve production. Our thanks to Dan Dorfman and Tom Veracruz and Jason Scheer for the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.